Hello everyone and welcome to our 7th episode at Ruby India. Ruby India brings together curated content from and for the Ruby Indian community and friends. We do a regular newsletter highlighting content from the people in the community. One of the aims of highlighting this content and their work has led us to start with this podcast. Today we have Sidhu and Niranjan from C42, which is based out of Bangalore. I'll ask them to introduce themselves.
Okay. I'll go first. This is Niranjan here. I started my programming career around 9 years back with Java and in Infosys. Quickly, I shifted to ThoughtWorks in a year and a half time, and that's where I got first introduced to Ruby. And ever since, I've been doing Ruby programming. I was pairing with Sidhu on one of the projects, Ruby project in ThoughtWorks. And while working with him, we realized that we really wanted to do something of our own. So one day, we decided to quit ThoughtWorks and start C42. And which is a premium Ruby consulting shop, and we have been working on that ever since for the last 4 years.
Yeah. So you started C42 in like 4 years ago.
Yes, we started C42 in 2010.
Oh. Yep. And yep. About Sidhu.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Sidhu. I've been passionate or in love with programming for a really long time, ever since. I think just through sheer good luck, my school had a computer programming course as long back as 1991.
Oh, wow.
Programming ever since then. And the usual progression, I think, for anybody who's studied programming like I have, which is you start with Loco, then GW Basic, then Q Basic, then C, then C++. Then after that, I mean, then that brought me up to college. And then after that, I started working at ThoughtWorks right out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I was introduced to Ruby, because there were a lot of thought workers globally who were very interested in the language. And around the same time was when Rails came out, late 2004. And I remember that ThoughtWorks India had what was, as far as I know, to my best knowledge, the first commercial Ruby project in India. And so in the company, there was a lot of exposure. And come to 2006, and at this point, I still wasn't programming in Ruby, but it was something that was very much on my radar because so many people were talking about it. And in 2006, I was working on a startup with a friend, you know, a night job, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
And he and I both were going to pick Ruby because it was interesting. And he went ahead and picked up Rails. And that's how I started writing code in Rails in 2006. And that drew me into Ruby. And that company and that product gained a lot of traction, but we couldn't raise money and we shut it down. But my love for Ruby didn't stop. And so I started digging into Ruby, studying Ruby, writing about Ruby in 2007. Got involved with the Bangalore Ruby user group, which was really tiny at that time. And that just has stayed since then. And now it's been so many years, and I still really enjoy programming in Ruby, and it's still my language of choice. So yeah,
that's, so you have from 6 or 7 you have been working.
Yes, 2006 is when I first wrote my in the bad old days when it was Lighty and FCGI Lighty, and we had to reboot the server. My friend's mom had to reboot the server 3 times a day.
I was like in high school that anyway. You also, currently what all different things do you do with Ruby in your day-to-day work? Like, what are your experiences with Ruby, and what are the things you work in Ruby, and what things interest a lot about Ruby?
So, I'll take this first because these days I don't have that much to say because I'm turning suit slowly at C42. So, I get to scratch my itch just a little bit. So my Ruby is fairly limited on in terms of me hacking on many projects in the company, Skunkworks projects. Web applications, of course, you always have these side projects in the company that you always want to work on. But other than that, I do hack around a little bit with JRuby stuff for my own, on my own machine, just to play around with it. And I still tend to prefer scripting on my machine in Ruby, rather than using shell. I'm much happier writing all of my automation scripts or whatever I need to keep my own laptop in place in Ruby rather than going into shell or installing another operating system like Emacs.
Nice. So, and this is somewhere on your GitHub, like your open source trip?
No, I haven't. I mean, because these are all throwaway things. I don't think anybody else needs them. But if I'm just doing things like organizing my media, you know, stuff where it's just so much easier to just write a small program to do it for you, I still other than that, I think, you know, outside of my consulting work, I tend to prefer to do my, I do a fair amount of coaching these days, and I prefer to do my coaching as well in Ruby. And that's really my primary use case these days for Ruby, is using it as a teaching tool. And I think I got into that with RubyMonk to begin with, and now it's continued where all of the training programs that I run for corporate clients, I prefer to run on Ruby if that's an option. So that's pretty much it from me.
What kind of programs are these? Like, what all things do you discuss in all these programs from GDD to onwards?
Sure. It's fairly varied, but the majority of the program focuses on software engineering. And so, you know, it's fairly abstract and applicable to almost any kind of platform or technology, but with a special bias towards object-oriented languages. And that's why I prefer to have Ruby as my teaching medium for this, so that I can talk about simple problems, like how do we build a model, something like a rectangle and a square and a line, or how do we model something simple like a calculator, and iterate over this and extract out all of the design philosophies or object-oriented principles that you would apply to write a well-tested, test-driven, object-oriented, well-factored, decoupled code base. You know, I'm throwing all of these terms in there because there's one sweet code base at the end of it, right? And the whole course really focuses on how do you ship a sweet code base? How do you keep shipping a sweet code base day after day after day while absorbing constant change in requirements, constant change in business context without, you know, slowing down and saying, oh my God, my code base is too crufty now. We can't add this feature without doing a rewrite or cleaning up for the next 3 months.
Right.
The course focuses on software engineering, fundamentally. And Ruby is more a medium rather than the objective of the course.
And in Niranjan, you're mostly involved in consulting.
Yes. So when it comes to usage of the language in consulting, I can broadly categorize it in two parts. One is a day job, which is actually working on the projects. So C42 is a services company. And most of the times, we are dealing with startups, US startups, in their early product stages. So we build different kind of applications for them. Sometimes they are like full-blown Rails applications wherein we are managing, like, starting from UI back to actual web servers, like programming the web server itself and writing business logic. Whereas sometimes we directly go to something like Sinatra, which is much lighter, lightweight, which we can use for API building. But the spectrum, while the spectrum is broad, the language of choice remains Ruby. So that is part of the day job. And apart from that, even when it comes to, say, hacking around to set up a server, Chef and Puppet is the tool to use it. So using Chef for machine setups or writing small scripts, say, for example, Sidhu mentioned that he doesn't like an operating system like Emacs, but I am in love with it. So, how do you set up Emacs? Obviously, you use So, obviously, you use Elis to set up Emacs. But to get started, typically, I write simple Ruby scripts to, you know, set up my entire environment, dot files, fetch things from Git. So, I actually use it as a scripting language on local machine.
Nice. I've never heard, I mean, this kind of use here. I mean,
basically, it boils down to a choice saying that I need to get this done. I have a choice between writing Shell and writing Ruby. That's kind of a no-brainer for me.
Yeah. Right.
As you know, like, Ruby actually started as a scripting language, and it's a beautiful scripting language.
Correct. Okay. Next thing, like, I wanted to discuss, and this is something which I have not been able to discuss with many people, is what was the early Ruby community in India, and what was it like when it started, got started, how the meetups happened, and how it expanded, as also how the RubyConf India came into being, and how overall that experience was?
So that's actually a bit of a funny story, because what happened was that while I was at ThoughtWorks, one of the very, very active communities, and fairly notable for that, technical communities, was the Bangalore Python user group.
Mm-hmm.
And it so happened that we knew a few people there. It was not unusual for us to host the meetup in the ThoughtWorks office. And as Ruby started to grow on the horizon and I started to use it, I started to wonder, listen, I mean, clearly there are a lot of people in ThoughtWorks who use this. I do get the sense from the net that there are enough other people in Bangalore who do too. But somehow we don't seem to be doing any meetups. So I looked around. I found there was actually a mailing list already in place with some people on it. Saurabh had started the mailing list, I think, in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And Satish Kota, a few other, you know, really early people were there. And I think this must have been maybe mid to late 2006 or early 2007. I don't quite remember. And so we said, you know, why not? Let's do this. So we got our first meetup. And I remember it was really funny because basically it was about seven of us in the room occasionally talking about Ruby and mostly trying to figure out if we could hire each other.
Okay.
So I think that one of the main drivers in the early days for Ruby was in fact and I think it's still true today, but
yeah,
it was much more visible in those days, is that there were so few people who were on the ground who knew what they were about. And so the meetups really, you know, were driven from the corporate or business angle because so many people wanted to hire. And of course, the first meetup very quickly showed us that there are only so many of us and none of us are ready to get hired by each other. And so we said, okay, this is interesting. But it grew very, very steadily from there. And I think around 2010, maybe 2009, 2010 was when it really started taking off.
Yeah.
And I think now we have 800 plus people on the Bangalore Ruby list alone. And in parallel, we've seen over the same time period other lists really come to the fore. So we have the old stalwarts, you know, Chennai Ruby, Pune Ruby. And then you have all the new lists which have so much good activity on them, like Mumbai Ruby or Kerala Ruby or Goa Ruby. And we're starting to see that the growth is accelerating now in terms of numbers, interest, engagement levels. And that has been a really interesting journey. So RubyConf was the other thing you asked me about, and RubyConf also has its genesis again with the Python guys. So in a way, I think there is a big shout out to be given to the Python guys. You know, Naufal, Anand, everybody from Bank Papers.
Mm-hmm.
They put together PyCon in India for the first time, I think, in 2009. And it was a national conference. There was a big audience. We went for it, and again the question came up. Look, you know, these guys are so active and they're doing this. Why is it that we're not doing this? And and so again, we started looking around. We started seeing what does RubyConf elsewhere look like? What does RubyConf, like the primary RubyConf in the US, look like? How do they organize? And from there, we started trying to figure out what it would cost to put together a similar event at a similar scale in India. And over here, I think there is no way to understate the impact that ThoughtWorks had on the whole situation. Because everybody in ThoughtWorks was super supportive. Our immediate boss in Bangalore, Sita, was super supportive of the idea. He raised it all the way to Roy, who was the head of ThoughtWorks. And Roy was super supportive. And the amount of effort that goes into putting this together when you're almost going solo, if you know what I mean, there isn't a large community movement, there isn't momentum around fundraising, when all of these things are scarce.
And even for that matter, when it comes to operations,
yeah,
the hotels here are not used to hosting big
technical conferences, internet, all of this. It's very easy to underestimate today, sitting here, how hard it was to pull all of this thing together from the funds, from the operations. And ThoughtWorks was critical in every respect because they funded most of it, even though they did not officially, you know, their donations were far more actually than the real number that was quoted there. And a lot of that came in not cash terms, because the immigration team supported all of the foreign people who were traveling for the conference, which would have been a nightmare for us because we didn't know anything about it. The finance team supported us on setting up, you know, helping us set up a non-profit and then helping with all of that. And then internal marketing helped marketing it. And it was crazy. Like, the infrastructure team spent a whole sleepless night setting up all the routers and getting the internet set up in Royal Orchid in Bangalore.
Even the head of technology of ThoughtWorks at that time, Ajay Gore, he spent weeks and weeks just working on the conference and getting things in place.
Yeah, so if we have a fairly significant conference today with a very strong following, a good attendance,
mm-hmm.
and a sort of a mature execution to it. It is because that threshold was crossed entirely because of ThoughtWorks' support. Yeah. And we got over that hump. Otherwise, we would have been forced to start small and grow organically out from there. And so we leapfrogged that entire step. And then slowly over time, you know, as our systems got set in place, the second conference, by the time we got to the third conference, we knew the drill.
Yeah.
And fortunately, like, we moved to Pune, and fortunately, Gautam and Satish joined the team, and that was super helpful.
And it is the kind of drive and effort that has been put in by Satish and Gautam, having the conference running in Pune for 2 years, and then the Goa conference between Ajay and Gautam. It is crazy the amount of effort and time they put into this. And I think most of the credit needs to go to these guys for getting it off the ground.
I had experienced this while in Deccan RubyConf, which was pretty smaller. Even if it was smaller, there was like a lot of effort that goes in arranging such an event.
Absolutely.
Another thing was, if I'm not mistaken, you were the first guys who spoke at RubyConf in US. Some experiences about that.
I don't know if you were the first. One clear memory I have, because this was very shortly after RVM came out.
Mm-hmm.
So I really remember that, because before that I had like 6 different versions of Ruby on my machine, switching was a pain, all of that circus. RVM came out, I'd been using RVM for about a year, and I saw Wayne Seguin at the conference. I mean, he was just one among so many of these open source people, but I really remember this because RVM really took a big pain away from me. And this feeling was basically of saying, oh my god, that guy, he saved me so much time and effort, I want to go hug him and buy him a beer. That guy. And basically, it's just you go to this conference and you see all of these people whom you want to go and hug. Because it somehow saved you time, effort, pain, suffering, something by some amazing open source library they've written. So that contrast, I cannot overemphasize. Yeah. When you're in an environment surrounded by the people who have created all of the tools and the libraries that you use, it's a completely different experience. And that was something that we really wanted to bring to India, which is why there is such a focus in RubyConf India on identifying key members of the global Ruby community who are main contributors and bringing them in here so that the local community can interact with them face-to-face on a casual basis. And then you get role models, you get so much out of it, right? But if I had to point to one thing about that experience which really stood out, it was this feeling of like a kid in a candy shop, except that instead of eating the candy, I want to go hug people, you know?
And it has been like, it has been a nice experience also. Like, I got to meet, in 2012, I got to meet a lot of nice people.
Right.
So it was pretty awesome. Next thing I wanted to discuss is about you founding C42 and what all the things you've worked on, like Ruby Monk or Trusted Rishta.
Right.
A bit about that.
Sure. So we've always tried to be a company that focuses on technology, but is always trying its hand at building out products, because that really is a hard problem. And it's also a really interesting problem. I mean, I can't think of many engineers I've met who say that, oh, you know, I'm cool not building a product, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's the exact opposite. They're like, oh, the first chance I get, I'm building a product. And I think that itch is something that needs to be scratched. And you see that itch getting scratched with things like RubyMonk, products like RubyMonk, products like Trusted Rishta. And we've always tried to make sure that we are a stable business, growing business with strong cash position in order to support our endeavor in product originally. And that is one thing that, frankly, if I look back on the last 4 years, I'm not too thrilled about. I think that's hindsight operating there, it's experience operating there. But if I had to do it over again, I would definitely do the product, but probably a little later.
Mm-hmm.
Not so soon, because we dived into building products just 18 months into launching the company. And I think we left a lot of things up in the air, and we ended up juggling so many balls that we didn't do justice to everything. But
right.
Fundamentally, the TLDR is every engineer has that itch which has to be scratched, right? Which is filled with engineers. Now, that itch needs to be scratched, and it's just going to happen. And so I think While the products themselves have not necessarily made us money, RubyMonk runs as a donation supported entity right now, and even the donations are very scarce. Frankly, T42 Engineering is sponsoring RubyMonk entirely just because of the community impact it has. But we've had a good experience on the traction side. So RubyMonk now is seeing 350k people annually use the site, and at least 100k of them use the site very seriously. Like, they will complete a decent chunk of the course.
Wow.
So we're definitely seeing people gain value from it. We get feedback on Twitter. So we're very happy to keep it running. And I suspect we're going to continue investing in products because the itch has to be scratched. Mm-hmm. But now we're being much more disciplined and focused about our execution around both consulting and product, and making sure that we don't create a situation where we are constrained because we're trying to deal with multiple facets of consulting, multiple facets of product, all at the same time.
How exactly do you manage your, the time available for consulting, and then if there's time available, then work out something for the product?
So that, if I had an answer to that question, I I think what we've learned is all the things you should not do. What you should do is still an ongoing learning for us. But I can definitely say that one realization we've had is that if you're solving a problem of any kind, at any scale, so to give you an example, now whether you are responsible for a project for a client,
mm-hmm.
or whether you're responsible for running a company, or whether you're the product manager on a product of your own, irrespective of the scope of the endeavor itself,
mm-hmm.
The kind of energy and thought cycles it consumes is the same. So what I'm trying to say is that in terms of focus, concentration, and attention paid to detail, whether you're running a project or running a business or running a product, you're tied up equally. Your mind is not looking at this and saying that maybe this is bigger or there is more money to be made here. It is equally time consuming. So it's very important to pick one thing that you're focusing on at any given point in time. Get it to a stable situation where it is self-sustaining before you let your attention get diverted at all. That is one thing that I can say with some degree of confidence after these years.
After that, I wanted to touch upon a bit on your experiences. You spoke about Bangalore Ruby. A bit about experiences with meetups, like small meetups and community events, and how they got started. And what are the different events, not on a larger scale, but on a small scale, what all different events that have happened, and how does it actually help as a company or even as part of the community?
That's a good question. I'm trying to dig into my memory now because it's been so long. I'm trying to think of the variety of events. And, at some level, a meetup is a meetup is a meetup, if you know what I mean. But at the same time, depending on who's at the meetup and what you're talking about, each meetup can be so different from the next one.
Yep.
So I don't think I can very easily organize the meetups themselves into different categories.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say that...
So things like there's been Rails Girls in Bangalore, there's also been a code retreat and all those things.
Right. So actually the code retreats, etc., Niranjan has been driving. Niranjan, maybe you'd be a better place to talk about your experiences with all the different kinds of meetups that we've been involved with.
Sure. So I got into the Bangalore Ruby community in 2009, and ever since, we start meetups, we continue meetups for maybe 6, 8, 10 months, and we miss one Friday or one Saturday, and then everything stops. And then you have to again put in effort and start it again. And every time you go through that cycle, the nature of meetups slightly changes. Because of the participant involved, do change. So I remember in early 2009, the meetups were mostly people who are interested in Ruby coming to the meetup who are not actually working in Ruby full time.
Yeah, maybe like a quarter of the people who would show up were actually working on Ruby at their day jobs.
Yeah. So almost every meetup will end up talking about basics of Ruby, why Ruby, how to do meta programming, what are things to watch out for, and so on and so forth.
Like the kind of questions that anybody who's really good at another technology or platform and is coming into Ruby for the first time is likely to ask. That became the lion's share of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. So that was early 2009 till mid 2010. But as the community started maturing and overall Ruby ecosystem in India started growing, specifically in Bangalore, the nature of the meetups slightly changed. With more senior people coming for the meetups, it started becoming more like, hey, let's talk about how GC in Ruby works, or how we are going to do profiling, or here's a new framework which I just found out, no one is using it, but let's have a serious conversation about it, how we can integrate with RabbitMQ. And meetups started becoming more and more serious and technical.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good experience, and it still is. Today, if you come for Bangalore Ruby user meetup, there'll be someone presenting about some new technology they have found, people talking about different languages, comparing Clojure to Ruby, so on and so forth.
And in the interim, over the course of 2013, we had dropped out of consulting for about a year. Like I said, we realized that we need to have extreme focus on any one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And during that period, we stayed out of all of our usual community stuff as a matter of discipline as well. Mm-hmm. So almost for 1 year, we were not seriously involved. I mean, that year, none of us were on the RubyConf organizing team. We weren't really helping out with anything. But one very powerful thing happened in that interim, which is that the meetups in Bangalore started coming onto a schedule. And now we have a fairly regular system where we have every month. Skip months are relatively rare. It's not that they don't happen, because maybe every Saturday in the month has some, you know, festival or a cricket match or something, so attendance is scarce, so we can't organize the event. But by and large, we've got a high degree of consistency right now, and that is something which is really impressive.
Yeah.
And the same aspect in terms of maturity of the community started reflecting in other areas as well, which is focus on code design and code quality.
I can't agree more, because I still remember, like, as recently as I think 2010 or 2011, being at a meetup and somebody asked the question, so what happens when you have, you know, you're expected to write tests for your code, because nobody really writes tests for their code, right? And that person was looking around the room, you know, waiting for everyone to jump up and say, hey, you know, these stupid tests, they're such a pain. I don't know why anyone expects us to write them. And there were, in fact, a few heads nodding in response to that. But things are so different now, because you come for any of the conferences, the community conferences, GCRC in Bangalore, Deccan Ruby in Pune, or even the national conference. And there is nowhere that you can go and say a sentence like this and not have everyone jump on you and say, you know, listen, what is wrong with you? You just do not ship quality software without unit tests. Unit tests are absolute minimum. If you can't test drive your code, we live with that, so that's not nice. But unit tests at a minimum are, you know, just 101. If you don't have those, I don't believe your code works. And this is just a change in a short period of 3 years.
What I was saying was the same change also led to starting events like Code Retreat and Hacker Nights and all those things. Because finally what it boils down to is Code Retreat is a bunch of people just come together, hack on a code base, game of life, one simple problem, entire day. For eight times, pairing with different people and learning new things. And more than learning, it is mostly practicing and bringing your skills out. So that we have been doing for quite some time now. And
in fact, we are now, we've had such a good experience with Code Retreats, the format specifically, in terms of the experience that the community members have when they come in for the event, that we are planning to now regularize it and run a Code Retreat every month out of the C42 office in Bangalore. So that's something that's on the cards. We're going to be starting that most likely next month.
So, I was going to ask about, along the same lines, in this time period, what all different things did you happen to see in work involved in open source projects, or how the community was involved, or how, in fact, you guys got involved in some of the open source work?
Right. So I think the first thing that happened was that we had enough of our own stuff that was potentially valuable as open source. Mm-hmm. And we just started pushing that out. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't mean that any of this was particularly successful. But I think it's important to be comfortable with the mindset that if you're building something and it's potentially useful to somebody else, you just get it out of the door.
So on the open source, the way we started, the first big project we did together in open source.
I'm just going to stop you guys. I'm not able to hear you.
Oh, is it better now?
Yes.
Yeah. So the first serious open source project we worked together was REST, which is a, what do you call it, HTTP library. And it is a funny story. The way it started is we were using Active Support
mm-hmm.
on one of our projects on Rackspace to talk between services. And Active Support was really, really bad when it comes to design actual implementation, the way it communicates. So Sidhu decided that he wants to write a better Active Resource. And we started writing that. And while writing Active Resource, first we realized that to talk to a remote service, we need a decent HTTP library. And most of the HTTP libraries available at that time didn't follow any object orientation and standard convention.
And we're talking about fairly major projects, like REST client and HTTP party, both of which I found I wasn't very enthused about their design.
Right.
So at the end of the day, it was nothing complicated. It was just a wrapper around NetHTTP. And in those days, I don't know if anybody remembers this anymore, but Ruby's HTTP libraries were really flaky. So if you wanted it to be totally reliable, you had to depend on curl. So we supported both NetHTTP and curl through libcurl.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nothing more than a nice API. And frankly, most of the people that used it were current or ex-Hotworks people.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I got into, I actually don't remember how I got into it. Oh, yes, I do. So yeah, this was, I think a lot of our projects come out of the fact that there is such poor design in so many of our code base. So I was working on writing tests for action for controllers.
Mm-hmm.
And action controller is so poorly factored that it is so hard to latch onto objects to test inside of it.
Yeah.
And what I really needed was the ability to latch onto any object of a particular type, any instance
mm-hmm.
right, of a given object so that I can stub it, mock it, set expectations, do whatever. And that led me to digging into RSpec mocks to figure out if that was possible. And over multiple iterations, we got any instance shipped. So any instance in RSpec was built by us over a period of almost a year going back and forth.
Nice.
And one thing I can definitely say about the experience, David Chelimsky was leading the project at that time. And he was a superb mentor.
Mm-hmm.
I learned so much from the refactorings he made on our commits before pushing them. And he would take the time. He would accept a pull request, refactor it, push it, and then hop out to IRC and explain to me why he made the changes he made. And that was such a great educational experience. So
I'm sorry, who? I missed the name. David?
David Chelimsky. He was the maintainer of RSpec just before the current batch of Myron and Andy.
Right.
So that was a super experience. And I still recommend to a lot of people I speak to that if you're trying to learn, find a project with very, very friendly core team members who are willing to advise you and give you feedback on your code, and just start raising pull requests. There is no faster way to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a great experience. Then internally, we also started off on a CI server, and it's still out there. But it somehow, you know, these are all the projects where the itch is getting scratched, and then the itch becomes a different itch, and then the project tends to stagnate. But we have a CI server out there as well. It's probably a little dated today, but it wasn't half bad in, you know, 2011, 2012,
right.
Which my colleague Srishti had built from scratch. He was something of an expert on all of the problems you face when you're setting up CI. So he said, you know, all of the CI solutions really don't work well, so I'm going to build something better. So yeah, that's like a quick roundup. We also had a couple of other small libraries. You know, a common use case is that when you're trying to write controller tests, you mm-hmm. should be matching on response codes consistently. And so we just did a small matcher library to give you convenient matchers for your RSpec tests that deal with HTTP requests. So small stuff like that. Anything am I missing, Niranjan? Fox page in it, of course.
And how did you see the involvement in open source from the community over time?
So this has been one of the points that has been a constant source of frustration for active members of the community, which is how do you incentivize people in the community to stick their necks out and contribute, which is even funnier because you don't really stick your neck out, right?
Yeah.
And we have seen a steady rise, slow, very slow, but steady rise. And now we have some real superstars, right? Like Nufaid, Hemant from Codemancers.
Yeah.
Like the kind of portfolio he's got in open source contribution is non-trivial. We have mm-hmm. so many Rails core people in India now, mm-hmm. at least five or six off the top of my head from 2012. Now that number keeps varying as people drop in and out of core, but that's not a trivial number again.
Yep.
And that has been impressive. But I think we have a huge, huge gap to cover before we start to even remotely reflect the kind of energy and contribution that international communities bring to the table. And I think promoting contribution to open source as an intrinsic part of all of our community activities, including RubyConf, has been very important. In fact, last time at RubyConf, we started giving discounts or free tickets to people who could send in
a pull request,
right? Here's a link to a pull request which has been accepted. Your ticket's free. And there's no, and this is something we're going to continue from here on out. And we are very, very interested in any incentive system that we can support through the community to encourage our community to contribute. And, you know, very, very, here I'm not speaking for myself. I'm speaking for, like, the RubyConf organizers. Any thoughts or ideas around how we can incentivize open source contributions would be really welcome.
I mean, it's pretty hard.
Yeah, it is pretty hard. And like I said, you cannot underestimate the size of the gap between our Indian communities in open source and international communities. There is still a huge gap we have to bridge.
Right. Next thing I wanted to ask about is what kind of setup do you guys use in your day-to-day programming? Like, what all tools do you use, or what all editors do you use, and things like that?
Okay. It's a fairly long question, I would say. Honestly, the answer varies from project to project.
Okay.
One thing which we definitely use on almost every project is we obviously start with RSpec or TestNet. Okay. All the projects which we are doing are in Ruby, so that's the go-to language for every one of us. But on top of Ruby, what framework we would use, it varies depending on the project requirements. Like as I was saying earlier, sometimes we go Rails, sometimes we go Sinatra, and so on. We have also worked on like pure Ruby library, which is doing multi-threaded background crawl running on JRuby. And there was no web component whatsoever. It was almost like a background job. Okay. But coming to the tools themselves, there is a wide variety. Every programmer in C42 is highly opinionated about what kind of framework and tool chain they would like to use.
I'm specifically asking about like what all tools do you guys use?
Okay, sure. So obviously for managing Ruby versions, we use RBN throughout, and like shell is ZSH with lots of custom configurations. So it starts from there. It goes to editors. Again, choice of editors varies between Emacs, RubyMine, and Sublime these days. We used to use TextMate some time back, but now we are kind of stopped using that. Other than that, on the project management side and code quality side, we integrate with CodeClimate. Our repos are hosted on GitHub. Unless and until client provides their individual hosting, we try to move them towards GitHub, but sometimes it just doesn't work.
You do happen to use CodeClimate?
Yes. We do use CodeClimate for code quality checks.
So I just wanted to quickly interject here and point out that there is an interesting division in terms of our preferences across all of these. So it's not uniform. In terms of libraries themselves, like Niranjan was saying, everyone's opinionated. In fact, Niranjan and I ourselves would differ in terms of the tools we use. Niranjan is a huge Emacs fan. I'm not. I use RubyMine, though I'm not thrilled with it. I did enough Java programming in the bad old days to know what a real IDE looks like. And frankly, I find everybody that comes to me and says, oh no, who needs a real IDE? Ruby is such a flexible language. And we will use a text editor and kick ass. And I
use RubyMine?
I use RubyMine, but frankly, I find it disappointing. We still have a long way to go before you have the kind of productivity in Ruby that we take for granted in Java today.
Yeah, I know.
So I still do use RubyMine, though I'm not really excited by it as of today. It's okay. Right. But what I really find valuable about it is the fact that when you're building a web application specifically, it has very, very nice integration across all of the frameworks you would use, from Ruby to Rails to your CSS to your HTML to your JavaScript. It understands everything fairly seamlessly. And that really, to me, is where it shines. You know, I get a fairly consistent, powerful experience across multiple. But I just want to caveat that saying that it is nothing like what I'm used to from Java. And so that means that while I do use Ruby, mine, I'm perfectly happy to drop into a regular text editor because, frankly, you know, unless I'm constantly hopping from JS to CSS to Ruby, it just doesn't matter really.
Right.
And
In next thing, like to conclude with what I wanted to ask is about. So we were talking about tools that you guys use, but what are tools does your company use for, let's say, communication or handling workflow and all your thoughts about it?
Right.
Also, this is one question like I wanted to ask is, you said that everyone is opinionated about the tools or libraries that they use. Doesn't it create problems sometimes? Because let's say someone is working on a project and someone else has to drop on that project.
Right.
Doesn't it create conflicts?
I think that's an excellent question, and that was something I was going to circle back to anyway. I think that on one side, you have an argument for standardization, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that everybody in the company uses the same set of tools, the same set of approaches, and so on. Because that makes it much easier to collaborate, and that's a very valid argument. But I think that in any complex situation, there are always two arguments in conflict. There's always a catch-22. And the catch-22 here is that if you settle on one set of tools, you need to make sure that those tools are the most effective for every problem that you deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that may not always be the case. So maybe the way I would define it is that we like to standardize, and we have standardized to a certain set of tools across our projects.
Okay.
But we are very, very willing to switch out of them if we find that in that particular case, there is something which is better. And in fact, that is our value proposition to our customers. Which is that, you know, we are actually bringing you a bespoke custom solution optimized for you. And that doesn't just mean the code base, it means how we work as well.
Correct.
Right. So
and what tools do you use for like communication or management, like project management and all those things?
Right. So internal communication runs on both email and Slack at the moment. So we have mailing lists inside the company for different things.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets used. We also have Slack with different channels, chat channels for different things. That gets used as well. We have Telegram for casual chat because no matter what you do, something like Slack on the phone is just not convenient. So we use Telegram for just casual chat in the company.
Mm-hmm.
For project management, I'll let Niranjan take this one.
Yeah. So project management is slightly trickier one because every project has different requirements. And what we like to stick to is extreme principles, which means that we have to go in, understand the situation, and then pick tools and tool chain appropriate for that project.
Okay.
It varies from project to project. We start with Pivotal Tracker, but sometimes we have to move to Trello or even GitHub issues, sometimes even Asana, depending on the needs of the given project and what is the best way to communicate with client on daily basis.
Correct.
Obviously, when I say communicating with client with daily basis, there's one huge technical advantage which we have today, which wasn't available, say, 6 years back, is video calls.
Mm-hmm.
So every project we are working on, we have at least one, if not two video calls every day with the entire team from our side and client side on the call talking about what's happening.
Right.
So I can summarize that by saying like the base thing that we would start with would be Pivotal Tracker.
Mm-hmm.
And email and you know, Hangouts or Skype. This is like the foundation of any project. And on the other side, we have Jenkins running as a CI server, which is sending updates to everybody. So these would be the core basic communication tools that we would start out with. And then we may add to them or replace them as the project progresses and as we understand more about what really works well.
Got it. In conclusion, we have some questions which people from Twitter have asked us. Like we had posted about, we'll be interviewing you guys, and there were some questions that came for you guys.
Sure.
So Sagar asks you guys, What are the fundamental challenges in building a web-hosted product out of India? That's one thing. And yeah, another question, I guess, which is related to it is like how you convinced a team to funnel services revenue into another team-building product.
Right. So let me take the first question.
Okay.
Which is, you know, what are the challenges with building web products out of India? I think there's a nuance there. The question is, are you building web products out of India for India? Or are you building web products out of India for a global audience?
I think it's safe to say that maybe both.
Yeah. So I can tell you very quickly that the challenge for web products out of India for India, it boils down into a very simple thing, cost of capital.
Right.
It is very, very expensive in India at the moment, in my opinion. So please take this with a grain of salt, in my opinion, to raise money for an India product. Because in India, it is really, really hard at the moment to prove traction, to prove this, to prove all the things that people take for granted that you can prove so easily in say the US, where 60% or 80% of the people are on smartphones, everybody uses the internet. And you compare that with India, where probably small segments of the urban population behave in that way and everybody else just runs away from a computer. That dynamic really queers the pitch. Right. And I would say that if you're talking about building a web product out of India for India, you should be focusing on very, very fundamental things like revenue and traction very, very, very early, because otherwise you can't raise money. And if you do raise money, the cost is punitive. And any event, even if you do raise money without proving these things, you are much more likely to fail in India because you just can't gather information that fast.
I think it was more the question was more towards what are the challenges building a product which is host like web-hosted product out of India.
So
let's say for services which are in US or for your own self, something like that. Like, what are some challenges that you see?
Sure. So one of the most important thing when it comes to product building, in our experience, the challenge doesn't come from the technology itself. The challenge comes from identifying the product, identifying the value proposition, going and talking to customers to understand what they really want, and then shipping it. So the major difference between product built in India for international community versus product built for Indian community is ability to go and talk to your customers. If you're building a product in India for Indian consumers, you can just get on a bike, go to someone and talk to them about, hey, these are my paper mockups. What do you think about it? What do you think we should improve? How will you use it? Will you pay money for it? Whereas if you're building a product for international community, that becomes one bottleneck wherein your customers are not necessarily available here to go and have a face-to-face meeting. Okay. And that poses a big challenge when it comes to building products.
And sorry, I should have clarified, because what I said about the cost of capital was me skipping a few steps, right? That's my end conclusion. I gave you the TLDR there.
Okay. But
suffice to say that in India, building a product for Indian market, there are several hops that you will go through. But at the end of the day, what it boils down to is not your engineering capability, but your ability to have staying power, your ability to last through the product cycle for an Indian product, which is going to be much longer than the product cycle for a global product or a US-oriented product. And that's why I circled in on the cost of capital, because that staying power becomes the primary stumbling block for a young company to ship a product.
And another question was how you convinced your team to funnel your revenue into building a team product. That, like, how did you invest your time?
It just boils down to the same thing. Everyone's got an itch. For the kind of people that we are and the kind of people that we work with, if you say that, guys, you know, here's money and here's a product, you'll go after product. I mean, we were just talking about it. It's been 4 years. We've built, you know, so many products and done so much consulting to support all of that. And frankly, at the end of it has not really left us monetarily significantly richer. And the best part about it is we don't really care. It has to get scratched.
Yeah. Our next question was your experiences applying a data-oriented approach to decision-making. I'm not sure exactly what that means.
Right. I think that's a question to which we are also figuring out our answer. But I can just give you a general opinion. This is I'm too immature in this area for me to answer this with any confidence, so I'll give you the brief blurb. Niranjan mm-hmm. also has something, so I'll just give it to him very quickly after summarizing. So, in my opinion, Niranjan, why don't you go first? I'll just collect my thoughts and then...
Sure. So, the reason data-oriented approach is required is because fundamentally, being an engineer, we almost always come from a background that, hey, if I build something which I think is interesting, people will mm-hmm. come and use it.
Right.
And that's not the case.
The case. Yeah.
Okay. Even if you build something superlative, people might not come. Because right. you're not essentially building product for yourself, you're building for product for others, and you need to empathize with them.
Right.
And the best way to do that is you throw something out there, you build a small product, or even sometimes not even a hard, like, not even any product per se, but even paper mockups, and then mm-hmm. go and talk to people, get their feedback, and then based on that, continuously improve. Once you have the basic product out, it becomes a lot easier because you have more wider audience to talk to. Mm-hmm. So you start doing A/B testing, you start tweaking your site, and you continuously keep collecting data in terms of what is sticking and what is not sticking.
Right.
And that's what guides your decisions in terms of how to improve conversions, how to get bigger market capital, how to get...
These are some of your experiences from RubyMonk. These are some of your experiences from RubyMonk, right? Like what
yes.
What all courses did you have to... what all new courses you wanted to introduce and things like that?
So, various things. It starts from the course, like what course do I want to talk about? So, we did a survey on that. It goes mm-hmm. to as simple thing as the language of the text itself. When you're writing a book on RubyMonk, how do you write it? So if you look at the content on RubyMonk, it's always in first person, as if there's a teacher talking to a student.
Correct.
And people just love it. Rather, most of the people keep coming back to RubyMonk because of the style of the course and not just the content.
Correct.
And this information we gathered after doing experiments, figuring out what people like, what sticks, what we need to discard. And it's a continuous process. It never stops. No matter whether it is just MVP or it is product which is already making millions of dollars, the process doesn't stop.
Okay.
In fact, let me very, very briefly, I had a very brief point to make on this, is that I think this is applicable to any kind of decision making.
Your voice is a bit low.
Sorry. I was going to say that this, what I have to say here, applies to any kind of decision making. Not just product. So you're able to hear me clearly now, right?
Yeah.
Which is that your gut feel or your instinct, if it is not backed by data, can be so horribly wrong that it's not funny. So you need to get into a situation where no matter what your instinct tells you, that is merely an indicator. And then you're going to dig for data to support your instinct. And if you can't find data to support your instinct, you will have to ignore your instinct no matter how strongly you feel about it.
Correct.
And that is one thing which is very, very hard advice to follow in practice. I know I'm saying it, and I find it very hard to follow, but it's true.
Yeah, it is. We have one final question, which is from Ajay, which says, what is the secret sauce for startup interactions and bitter truths about starting up?
Secret sauce...
I don't think there's any...
not also for that. Is persistence and staying power.
Okay.
You know that when you're working in uncertainty, everything in the startup is uncertainty. You don't know what is going to be tomorrow, what is going to be day after. But you need to plan for that. You need to figure out different plans. And between the co-founders, you need to have very, very smooth communication and interaction
mm-hmm.
and ability to just stay your ground and have a resolve to solve any problem which world throws at you. And just come out of it.
What are some bitter truths about it? Like what all things?
Yeah,
so because you guys are managing. When you're managing a team, it's like you need to think about the finances and all those things. Like what are things do you think? Yeah,
I think that once you have people working with you,
mm-hmm.
who you're responsible for you're responsible for their salaries. I think that's one thing which hovers over your head constantly, right? It, you're not worrying about next month or the month after that. Even if you're in a great cash position, you know what it feels like when there is payroll to be met and no cash in the bank.
Okay.
You know that feeling. And that once that fear is in you, you know, it is there on your mind constantly. You may have a year's cash in the bank. You're still worrying about a year and 1 month from now, how am I going to pay salary? Okay, so yeah. That is a constant bugbear. But in terms of, you know, bitter truths, one thing I can definitely mention is that I think that a lot of people who start up from a sense of rebelliousness. At some level, there is an inclination to do something different. And I think that rebelliousness, definitely in our case, potentially in other people that I've seen, leads you to try to do things differently from everybody else in the world. Immediately. And that is very dangerous, because the way things are done in the world is for a reason, because they work. And when you're getting started out, you don't want to try to change your system, your approach completely upfront without validating whether it works or not. So what I would say is that everybody comes into this saying, I'm going to do this differently. Do it differently after you've done it like everybody else for a while. Do it incrementally and change gradually. Do not go big bang and say, I'm doing these five things completely differently and we're very different and hardly anybody anywhere else in the world does it and I'm going to do it. Because, you know, there is a good reason why hardly anybody else in the world does it.
Right. I mean, staying humble is pretty important in these cases.
Yeah. And to add to what Sidhu said, just like technology world, wherein you have to continuously learn new things to keep yourself updated, startup world is the same. You have to constantly go read books, read articles, understand what other people are doing, how they are doing it, and try to implement that in your own company. Try to figure out whether you can map those things to your own company or not, and just keep churning through that material.
Correct. With that, we come to an end with like all of the questions that I had and are from Twitter. It was wonderful having both of you guys. Like you made time for this particular event. It's pretty awesome that you did.
In fact, I was going to say that thank you very much. What you guys are doing with the podcast and everything with Ruby India is hard work. Believe me.
But it's all about like you guys. Yeah, there's such awesome people in community.
I just want to call it out because there is no you guys, right? I mean, we are all part of the community.
Yeah, right.
And something that's always underappreciated broadly is the kind of effort it takes to put together an endeavor like what you're doing. And I just wanted to say thank you. We're really grateful and we're very appreciative of what you guys are doing. It's not trivial. It takes effort. It takes time out of your busy schedules, your day jobs. And thank you.
Yeah. Thanks again, guys, for your time. Thanks, Niranjan. Thanks, Sidhu.
Thanks, Vipul.
Yep.